Yeah, well, thank you. I'd like to thank Mina and the organizers for inviting me to come out here. It's always fun to visit, and Mina and I go back, we were just discussing almost a decade where we were both graduate students at Stanford and had kind of ongoing collaborations over the years for various kind of projects, and a lot of what I'll talk about today is heavily influenced by her work and input as well. So I'm just going to say a little bit about the experiments we're doing in Reno, on where the theme is looking for not only axions but other new short-range physics using AMO-based techniques. And so when most of us, I guess, think about fundamental physics, often the first thing that comes to mind, of course, is the high-energy frontier, where we have gigantic particle colliders. The LHC, of course, has been very successful in finding the Higgs and is currently continuing the search for the elusive supersymmetry. But there's also another frontier in fundamental physics, which is the precision frontier. And being here at Perimeter, probably you've heard a lot of talks on this area as well, where the idea is to not push the scale of the energy of the system by going to higher energies in a collider, but rather doing very ultra-precise measurements, which can still teach you something about the physics going on at these really high energy scales. And so probably the most well-known example are experiments that are looking for electric dipole moments of fundamental particles, for example, neutrons, electrons, or certain nuclei, where these can provide alternative ways to search for supersymmetry or other high-energy physics beyond the standard model. Another example of a type of fundamental physics that's well-suited for looking for in the precision frontier is ultra-light weakly interacting particles. So for example, the axion is a well-motivated particle that is a dark matter candidate. And this is an example of an experiment that uses a precision technique where one looks for conversions of axions to photons inside a microwave cavity, where you try to detect a very, very small amount of excess power in the cavity as resulting from that conversion of the axion to photon. In this case, the axion is so light and so weakly interacting that the accelerator is really not the right tool for looking for this kind of physics, and one actually needs to do a precision experiment. So there are actually a number of experiments now around the world that are kind of coming up in this area of sort of tabletop fundamental physics, and even the popular media has paid some attention to this as well, where there's this article earlier this year in The Economist magazine that mentioned some of the stuff that we're doing as well as some of the other experiments in this area coming up in these sort of tabletop size scale experiments for these kind of effects. So in our particular lab, I wanted to mention two of the projects that we have going on, where sort of the overarching theme involves using resonant sensors. And so for the first half of the talk, I'm going to describe our experiments that use a very high quality mechanical resonance, namely in the form of optically trapped nanoparticles. And here we're going to be using these nanoparticles to do tests of gravitational physics. We're currently operating an experiment to search for deviations in gravity at kind of micron length scales, and in the future could potentially use a similar technology to look for gravitational waves. And in the second half of the talk, I'm going to mention an experiment that exploits a very high quality spin resonance, where we're developing a system that's based on NMR and laser polarized gases to look for exotic spin dependent forces, where the target that we have in mind is the QCD axion. Okay, so in this audience, I don't have to really motivate so much the theoretical underpinnings with the hierarchy problem and so forth. We have this desert of energy scales between the electroweak scale and the quantum gravity scale from 16 orders of magnitude, which requires you to fine-tune the Higgs bare mass squared and Lagrangian at the 32nd decimal point to get a physical value for the Higgs mass. And so, of course, supersymmetry is probably the most popular solution to this problem currently being looked for. Also, it has been pointed out that large extra dimensions theories could also explain this hierarchy problem, where this energy scale of quantum gravity basically comes up as an illusion where gravity essentially gets diluted as it propagates into the bulk of extra dimensions. And so this is not a fundamental scale, but rather the quantum gravity energy scale could be closer to TED scale. And this high scale is just an apparent effect of gravity getting weakened as it propagates into extra dimensions. So for us, what's important is that these either supersymmetry or for example, these large extra dimensions give us two concrete examples of theories that might cause signals in experiments that are intended to measure gravity at short distance, in particular, below a characteristic length scale, which is at the sort of millimeter scale. And so we can look for these effects of these theories in terms of this gravitational potential from changing its power law or acquiring a new exponential type form. And this is typically parametrized in this Yukawa kind of corrections in the Newtonian potential. So if I just have the ordinary Newtonian potential, where I have the product of the masses divided by the separation distance times Newton's constant, then the terms that I have in the parentheses represent new physics that modify this potential at short distance, where I have some exponential term here, where the length scale lambda in the exponential is the Compton wavelength of whatever the new particle is that's being exchanged. And alpha is just some dimensionless parameter characterizing the strength of the new interaction relative to one, which is the strength of gravity. And so, for example, in supersymmetry or in the context of string theory, there can be particles such as moduli, radions, dilatons, things that describe the shape and size of extra dimensions, which could naturally give you interactions that are occurring at the kind of sub-millimeter length scale. And then also there can be these ideas of particles in extra dimensions, gravitons, but also possibly scalars or vector particles, which could also contribute these kind of exotic interactions. Okay, so if I look at the experimental landscape now for how well gravity has been tested over a wide range of distance scales, it looks something like this. So here I've got the length scale. I've got this Yukawa form for the potential again on the top. The length scale going all the way up to solar system scales here at 10 to the 15 meters down to 0.1 microns in the laboratory scale. And so you can see that if we look at sort of the Earth-Moon kind of distances with data, for example, from lunar laser ranging, then the bounds on this strength parameter, this correction parameter here, are about 10 to the minus 10. So we know to better than a part per billion that this gravitational 1 over r potential holds at kind of Earth-Moon distances. But now if I start looking on the left side of the plot, where I get down to laboratory scales, in particular getting down to scales below micron kind of scales, now the bounds that I can place on this new interaction get considerably worse, where in fact at a length scale of about 0.1 microns, we could have a force that's about 10 billion times stronger than gravity, yet there'd be no experimental constraint that would rule that out. And so doing these kind of tests in the laboratory is difficult, and it can be understood for the following reasons. So one of the challenges is just the way the gravitational force scales with the size of objects. So if I have two nearby spheres, for example, that have radius r, and I bring them as close together as possible, I can ask how does the Newtonian force scale with that size of the system if I just scale everything according to that size scale r. And it turns out that the Newtonian force goes like the positive fourth power of the radius, which gets weak very, very quickly once I start getting the size of the object small. And so in particular, if I'm interested in a length scale, let's say about 10 microns or 10 to the minus 5 meters, then this force, the Newtonian force here that you need to be able to measure to detect that is about 10 to the minus 21 newtons, or a zepto-newton if you want to use the prefix from SI. And so since most of us here are probably not in the force measurement business, and probably a lot of us don't even use the units of newtons, I just want to give some sense of scale for how small of a force that is. And so this is a nice cartoon I like to show where you have if I have a person sitting on a bathroom scale, let's say if they weigh about 70 kilograms, then in the Earth's gravitational field, they'll put a force of about 700 newtons on that scale. If the scale was very precise, I might be able to tell the difference between, say, 700 and 700.1 newtons, say, at the 10 to the minus 1 level. But if I wanted to detect, for example, a dust mite that came along and landed on their shoulder, I'd have to have a resolution to be able to detect 10 to the minus 7 newtons. Or for a bacteria, 10 to the minus 15. Or a virus, 10 to the minus 19. Or how about one extra carbon atom landing on the shoulder? You need about 10 to the minus 25 newtons. So the forces we're trying to see here are somewhere in between being able to detect if an extra carbon atom and a virus landed on someone's shoulder. To give you another point of reference for those of you that might be familiar with techniques used in the condensed matter physics community, the atomic force microscope, which is a very sensitive force detecting instrument, typically measures forces that are about 10 to the minus 11 newtons. So we're about 10 billion times the sensitivity we need to see these effects. At the same time, while these gravitational forces get really small when you start shrinking things down, the background from other electromagnetic forces starts to become much more significant. And so in particular, when doing these kind of experiments, one needs to be concerned with a couple of different background forces, one of which is a quantum effect, the Casimir effect, for materials that have no net charge. When I bring objects close together, there are quantum vacuum fluctuations that provide attractive forces between nearby objects, even at the same electrical potential. And these effects can often easily swamp the signal from these gravitational effects. Also, materials that we use in the lab are not the same perfect conductors that you hear about in electromagnetism textbooks. In fact, there can be local variations of electrical potentials on surfaces of materials, and this can cause so-called patch potentials or local forces between objects that are electrostatic in nature. Okay, so a way of getting at measuring some of these really tiny forces involves resonant detection. And here's an example of a prototypical resonant force detector. This is the cantilever beam. It's basically a diving board. We can think about it like a spring. If I apply a force on the end of the diving board, then I get some displacement. And there's some spring constant that characterizes that displacement. If I apply this force sinusoidally, I can take advantage of the fact that this system has a natural resonant response frequency. And so if I apply the force in a time-varying way right at the resonance frequency, then I'll see its amplitude get enhanced by a large factor, which is the mechanical quality factor, or the measure of how little dissipation there is in the system. And so on resonance, I get an enhancement of this amplitude of oscillation by this quality factor Q, which for micromechanical and nanomechanical systems can be quite large, on the order of 10 to the 5 or even as high as 10 to the 7 in some systems. And so this is a really nice way of taking a very small force that's input and turning that into a very large amplitude displacement that you can use to detect that tiny effect. And so you can ask, well, what is the fundamental limitation of this technique for detection? And so it comes from Brownian thermal noise. And so one can imagine in this analogy with a particle, dust particle moving around inside of a fluid, the fluid molecules come along and randomly kick the dust particle and cause its motion to undergo some Brownian jitter. And so similarly, if we have one of these resonant cantilever beams, it's in contact with the thermal environment at some temperature, and so the thermal environment essentially gives random kicks to the cantilever just due to that contact with a finite temperature bath. I can write down the equipartition theorem from statistical mechanics and then derive that in the presence of those random thermal kicks, there's a certain minimum detectable force that I can see on top of that background of these random kicks that goes like the thermal energy KT times the spring constant times the measurement bandwidth divided by this mechanical quality factor Q and the resonance frequency of the system all to the 1/2 power. So we can plug in some numbers here. So this is an example of an experiment that I took part in as part of my PhD work at Stanford, where we used these cantilever type sensors to do a gravitational test. So these are silicon cantilever beams. They're 250 microns long, 50 microns wide, and only a third of a micron thickness. And plugging in some numbers, we have a sensitivity that's on the order of 10 times 10 to the minus 18, or 10 attonewtons per root hertz in a cryogenic environment at 4K with a mechanical quality factor of about 10 to the 5. And so using this sensitive detector, we took this cantilever beam and we stuck a gold cubic test mass on the end of the cantilever beam, and then looked for gravitational interactions between this test mass and a nearby mass. And so what we have here is a patterned mass where we have sections of dense gold material and then less dense silicon material. And then this mass is sitting on top of an actuator, which can move the mass back and forth. And so when this mass moves back and forth, then the density that's closest to the gold test mass varies as the mass device is moving back and forth. That creates a modulation of the gravitational force on the test mass and then gives me a signal that I can detect as through the motion of the cantilever beam. And in between the two, in order to take care of these electromagnetic backgrounds and Casimir effects and so forth, we have a metal-coated conducting membrane, which is intended to screen out the electromagnetic backgrounds between the two. And so in this system, we were able to obtain the best limits for these Yukawa kind of deviations from gravity at the length scale of about 10 microns. And so now let's look at the current length scale constraint force distance parameter space again as of now, but now zoomed in on the kind of laboratory end of short distance end of that scale, where I'm here now going from 100 microns down to 10 nanometers on the x-axis. And here, now this correction term alpha is now a positive exponent, so ranging from 1 times gravity at the bottom up to about 10 to the 15 times gravity at the top. So the yellow area here is what's been excluded by previous experiments. This cantilever experiment I mentioned has the best limits here around the 10 micron length scale. At larger length scales, there are very nice torsion balance experiments operated at the University of Washington, which provide the best constraints above 10 microns. And below 10 microns, there have been Casimir measurements or adaptations of Casimir force measurements, which have been setting the best limits below that. The theoretical, some of the predictions from the models I mentioned at the very beginning are shown as some of these shaded areas here, where we're looking, for example, for moduli or gauged particles in the bulk in the green.
So this is the paper we were looking at the other day, the Chen paper.
Yes, this is from it's basically an adaptation of a Casimir measurement from the Chen group. That's right.
So is it the paper where they had the anomalous force at 200 nanometers?
Yes. Yeah. This is just as published, right? So this is a fairly recent paper. This paper was under review for quite a long time, and there was some possible controversy over it. But I'm just reporting what was published. So this limit may, in fact, depending on the controversy, may be not quite as good as advertised, but it's somewhere around there. Okay. So you can ask, well, if I want to do better, how can I really improve the sensitivity in this for these kind of mechanical detectors? And so one thing we can look at is the dissipation in the system. So as I mentioned before, the sensitivity scales like 1 over this mechanical quality factor, square root. And so if we can improve the quality factor of these mechanical systems, whether it be the torsion oscillator or the cantilever or whatever, we can, in principle, get better force sensitivity. And so let's look at the cantilever beam as an example again. So what is causing mechanical dissipation in this system? You have clamping mechanism. You have the fact that there's energy loss through some connection to a substrate. You have surface imperfections. You also have internal materials loss. There's thermoelastic dissipation or heat flow as the material flexes. And these all contribute at some way to this mechanical quality factor and loss in these systems. And as a way of getting around that, one can imagine using a different technique from atomic and optical physics, where rather than having the solid-state cantilever beam, we can actually use optically levitated force sensor. And so the idea is to replace the cantilever beam by an optically trapped dielectric object. And so essentially, the way this works is if I take a dielectric object, for example, a microsphere, I can polarize it in the electric field of a laser, and I generate an optical potential, which goes like the polarizability times the electric field squared. And the electric field squared of a laser looks like the intensity of the laser. And so what this gives me is a potential that wants to confine a particle at the focus or of the maximum intensity point of a laser. And so we can use this light beam to exert radiation pressure forces on this object and hold it up in this optical potential. And so the advantage of doing this, now replacing this cantilever with this optically suspended device, is that by looking at the center of mass motion of this object, now we've decoupled this system very well from the environment. There's no more clamping mechanism. I'm not holding onto some substrate. And I'm not concerned any longer with the materials properties inside the sphere, but I'm just looking at the center mass motion of the object. So by monitoring the displacement of this optically trapped particle, I can now realize a very high mechanical quality factor oscillator. And so if I go to the limit where I suspend an object in the laser beam and then I pump all the air out so that I have a very high vacuum environment where there's very little damping from the background gas, we can get excellent force sensitivity. And so here it's now a plot of the force sensitivity, minimum detectable force, again, rewritten in a different way now with the damping coefficient and the mass of the object. Here is a function of the size of the particle, the sensitivity. And so for particles that are submicron in size, we can get sensitivities that are on the order of 10 to the minus 21 newtons per hertz in a vacuum of about 10 to the minus 10 torr, even working at room temperature, which is some orders of magnitude better than these solid state systems. There is some deviation from this scaling here that you see at the higher, for the higher sized particles. This is a quantum effect due to the scattering of photons in the laser trap that's somewhat intensity dependent. But for small particles, you can actually get pretty close to this limit here from the heating from the collisions of the background gas at 10 to the minus 10 torr. And so using this high sensitivity system, then, we are operating an experiment to continue the search for these Yukawa kind of deviations of gravity, where the setup looks something like what's in this cartoon here. So we have a laser beam inside of an optical cavity. This basically makes a standing wave where we have a periodic structure here of maxima and minima of the light intensity along this axis. And as I was mentioning earlier, if we take a dielectric nanosphere, we can create a potential that will trap it at the maximum intensity of the laser field. And so we can have several discrete locations along this axis where I can trap the particle where there's a local intensity maximum due to the interference between the counterpropagating beams. And so the idea is we take a nanosphere that's sub-wavelength in size, and we confine it at one of these antinodes of the standing wave that's close to a gold-coated mirror membrane, which is stationary. And then behind this mirror membrane, we have a drive mass device, which is made up of varying density material, like in the other experiment I showed, where we have dense gold and then less dense silicon sections of this material that is on an actuator that modulates or displaces this device up and down. When that happens, then the density modulation that the sphere sees causes a modulation in the gravitational force on the sphere, and then we can measure the motion of the sphere induced from that driving mass from the density modulation. And so using this system, then we project that we can be able to get many orders of magnitude improvement when compared to the other experiments because of our precise ability to localize the particle near a surface and because of this fantastic force sensitivity. Okay, so the actual experimental setup looks something more like this. So we have this optical cavity here along this axis, where behind this mirror we have the mass device that's shown here in the cartoon. And we also have another set of laser traps that are at 90 degrees with respect to that cavity that we use to initially collect and catch one of these particles. This is a scanning electron microscope image of one of the nanoparticles we use. It's 300 nanometers across a glass bead here. And then we also have some additional lasers, which I'll explain in a moment, that provides a stabilization for this trap, the so-called feedback beams. So here's a photo of what it actually looks like in the chamber. We have the cavity along this axis, and then we have these dipole trap beams that we use to initially catch the particle. This is the device that actuates the driving mass up and down behind the mirror. So the mass itself is this periodic structure of alternating gold and silicon for density contrast. So we fabricate that by basically etching grooves into a silicon wafer using semiconductor fabrication techniques. And then we deposit gold into the grooves. After we do that, we have this structure here with a little bit of corrugation on the top surface, which is not ideal for the experiment. So then we basically flip this wafer upside down and polish away the silicon from the backside. So when we do that, this is a photo, SEM picture taken during that step where I've now cut into the material so you can see what's underlying. So we remove the silicon down to the gold level until you leave only a small, thin layer of silicon above it. And this provides a nice density pattern here where this entire structure is buried underneath a uniform layer of silicon to eliminate any electrostatic variations in the force as you move the device. And this is the actuator that displaces the system behind the mirror. OK, so we start off by collecting one of the particles in this standing wave trap. This is achieved by these beams that are perpendicular to the cavity. So these are two counterpropagating beams with a slightly offset focus. If I look at the structure of these lasers, so they're primarily orthogonally polarized, so they don't exhibit very much interference. But if there is a little bit of the opposite polarization that we let through one of the beam axes. And so when we do that, then we get a little bit of interference, and we get a kind of a shallow standing wave or shallow lattice-type potential here that's formed along this axis. So here's a zoom in of this is the optical force along the axis of the laser. And you can see there are these periodic modulations where the force goes to zero at a number of different locations along this trap. And so what I can do is trap one of these nanoparticles in the standing wave at one of several different positions along that standing wave. Here's some data showing that when I do that, I can actually kick the particle with another laser and make it hop by one lattice site, which is basically spaced by half a laser wavelength from the original site. So we start out with the particle in this trap and then transfer it into the other trap with the optical cavity. Before we do that, we have to, in order to get high force sensitivity, we need to get into a high vacuum environment. So we start off when we first catch this particle, we haven't actually pumped all the air out. Because if we did, we'd have no way of mechanically catching it as it flies through the trap. So we actually work at a intermediate pressure when we first catch the particle, and then we pump out the air eventually to get down to the high vacuum limit. And so that actually turned out to not be trivial. And it turns out one has to take measures to stabilize the particle as you pump the air out. And we did some studies of trying to understand that. I'm not going to I'll spare you some of the details of that unless there are questions. But what we essentially need to do is feed back and create a stabilization system which allows us to pump the particle out to high vacuum where we have this really good sensitivity. And so the way we do that is we take the scattered light from the particle in the trap and we focus it onto a segmented photodetector which allows us to basically measure the displacement or the position of the particle. And then taking that displacement signal, I can then phase shift it to get a velocity signal. So knowing the instantaneous velocity of the particle, we can send a signal to an additional laser which allows us to put a velocity-dependent damping on the system. And so what I do is I do that in three directions so that we can, in all three dimensions, put a damping and cooling force on the particle in order to stabilize it, which allows us to get to this high vacuum regime. And so you might worry, since I told you I need this really high mechanical quality factor to get good sensitivity, if I'm now going to damp it using this velocity-dependent force, does that spoil my situation? Well, it turns out the answer is no, because the sensitivity here goes like the square root of this ratio, the temperature over the quality factor. And for this cooling method, we actually reduce this ratio. We actually keep this ratio fixed because we tend to reduce the quality factor and the temperature by about the same amount. So we get to keep the same sensitivity we would have had in the system originally with the high mechanical quality factor. OK, so once you're in high vacuum, you can actually measure very small forces using these kind of systems. So here's some data showing integrated measurement of a particle in the standing wave trap, where we've integrated down to measure forces as small as a few zeptonewtons, or 10 to the minus 21 newtons or so. And so this looks very encouraging because it puts us right in the range where we need to be for testing gravity with a competitive level at these small distances. So when one is in the business of measuring forces that are this small and that may or may not be there, generally, it's a good idea to convince yourself that you'd really see a force if it was that small, if it was there. And so you want to have some way of calibrating the system so that you're not fooling yourself into measuring zero and saying, well, the answer is zero. And so the way we do that is we have a couple different ways of doing that, one of which involves an electrostatic calibration. So it turns out that 90% of the particles that we catch in this laser trap do not have any electric charge, but the other 10% do, and they tend to have either one or two electrons. And so along our cavity here, we have a set of electrodes where we can apply a time-varying potential. And so this allows me to apply a known electric field. And from the known electric field, then, depending on whether the particle has either one or two electrons, I can get a known force. And I can use that to make sure that I'm actually seeing as small of a force as I think I am. And for those particles which are not charged, we can still use this standing wave structure of this optical lattice to give us a ruler, essentially, to calibrate this force spectrum, where basically if I cause the particle to move to an adjacent trapping position in the lattice, then this known spacing of this half wavelength can be used to calibrate the signal on my photodetector, and I can use that as another way of ensuring that, in fact, I'm seeing as small a force as I claim.
Andy?
Yeah.
How many do you do this simultaneously? How many do you trap at once?
So we have trapped many at once, but typically we like only one at a time.
Yeah. So this measurement happens, you have the charged guy at the same time?
Yeah, so with the charged guy, you could do the measurement with the field on and with the field off, right?
Okay.
Many of them, if they're not charged, then when you turn the field on, it doesn't do anything.
Okay.
But you can always do this other method where you kick the particle and use that as a check. And the nice thing is that we found the same answer when we did both methods, so we're fairly sure that it's right.
Can you do the kicking once you're in the vacuum?
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay, so as long as you have the feedback on.
Right.
Right. So the sensitivity at about 1.6 attonewtons per hertz at this level. At the moment, we're limited by technical laser noise. If we could improve that to get down to the vacuum limited sensitivity, would be somewhere down at this line where we'd be below the zeptonewton level potentially at that long time.
And
so we're working on improving that. Yeah.
Oh, sorry. It looks like you can keep this trapped for quite a long time.
Yeah, this is 10 to the 5 seconds
of
integrated data. Yeah, so I guess that's one encouraging thing is that the particle stays around forever, it seems, until the power goes out or something. But also, it remains neutral for many days in a row, which wasn't obvious from the onset. And the other thing that's really nice is it shows that the overall environment is quiet enough that this continued to average down at the zeptonewton level. So if there was other environmental noise or something, this may have leveled off at some higher level. So the system looks very promising for measuring these tiny gravitational signals. So at the moment now, we're transferring the particles from this original trap into this optical cavity trap, which is at 90 degrees with respect to that original trap, where we have one laser in that cavity to localize the particle, and then a second laser that we can use to both cool the motion of the particle along this axis and also read out its position with even better sensitivity. And so here's a photo, I guess, I don't know, maybe it's hard to see. There is a 300 nanometer particle now in this cavity trap, and we're working on optimizing the imaging and setup for this to hopefully gear up for some initial gravity measurements in the next sort of 6 months to a year kind of time scale. Okay, so one thing I just wanted to mention as another possible application of this method is the search for gravitational waves. There's been a lot of exciting things going on in the field after the recent discovery. And so these optically levitated particles can provide an alternative to these very, very long baseline interferometer kind of detectors, where there could be an advantage for making measurements at the high frequency end of the spectrum. And so the idea is basically you trap a particle inside of an optical cavity, which could be much shorter in length than these LIGO type detectors, where now we have lengths of, say, between 10 and 100 meters. And a gravitational wave can come along and change the physical distance between the mirrors in this setup. And when that happens, then there's a displacement of the particle with respect to the antinode of the light field where it's trapped. And this can cause the particle to oscillate around its potential minimum as a result of that gravitational signal passing. It's kind of like an optical version of the Joe Weber style bar detectors. We have this big aluminum a device that basically rings like a bell when a gravitational wave comes along at the right frequency. Here, that frequency is set by the mechanical resonance set by the optical intensity of the light. And so this type of approach could be competitive or beat the sensitivity of advanced LIGO at above sort of tens of kilohertz range in a much more compact type system. So in the interest of time, I'm going to skip some of the details of that and move on to the next part of the talk, which is related back to the dark matter and axions. And so I think everyone's pretty much in agreement that there's an overwhelming abundance of evidence that suggests that most of the universe is not the normal matter that we know about. And one of the leading candidates, in addition to the WIMPs, is the axion. And so axions are quite generically occurring in many theories beyond the Standard Model. And of course, the most well-motivated and famous of which is the QCD axion, which was invented for a reason having nothing to do with dark matter, which was namely to solve the strong CP problem, which is explaining why the theta QCD angle appears to be less than about 10 to the minus 10 for no good reason. There are a number of experiments that are currently looking for axions as a dark matter candidate. For example, the axion dark matter experiment with the microwave cavity that I showed in the very beginning of the talk, the CERN axion solar telescope, and then some other newer ideas for looking for axions that are lighter mass scales. In our case, what we'd like to do is take advantage of another way of looking for the axion, which is to exploit the fact that the axion acts as a force carrier and can mediate spin-dependent forces between objects when I bring them together at close distance. And in this way, we can actually think about sourcing the axion locally in the lab rather than trying to detect the cosmic axion as a background field. And so we are developing now, with some initial funding from NSF, what we call ARIADNE, the Axion Resonant Interaction Detection Experiment. So this is a collaboration between us at Nevada, as well as MENA here, as well as folks at Stanford, Indiana University in Bloomington, and then the Center for Axion Precision Physics in Korea, as well as the Korean Measurement Standards Laboratory, CRISS. And so to put this experiment in context with other axion searches and searches for axion-like particles, I just wanted to show this diagram for those of you that are more familiar with the field. So there are different kinds of sources of axions people are looking for, and then there are different kinds of couplings that people are looking at. And so one source is the cosmic dark matter axion field. Another possible source is axions from the sun, and then there can also be axions that are produced in the lab. The axion coupled to photons, but in fact it was invented to solve the strong CP problem, so it had better coupled to nucleons as well. And so the ADMX experiment with the microwave cavity is looking for the axion coupling to photons of this cosmic dark matter axion. The CERN Axier Solar Telescope is looking for solar axions, and the light shining through walls kind of experiments are looking for lab-produced axions through the coupling, or axion-like particles, rather, through the coupling of photons. There are new experiments that are being developed called CASPER, which look for the axion coupling to nucleons, looking to couple to the dark matter cosmic axion field. Our experiment is in this bottom corner here, where we're coupling to nucleons, but we're going to use lab-produced axions. And this way, we're going to be less dependent on cosmological assumptions or the dark matter local density on Earth. So conveniently, the QCD axion can be parameterized in terms of a one-dimensional parameter space, which is basically the mass of the axion, which is inversely related to the Petrie-Quinn scale. And so here's the axion mass going from kind of mega electron volts here all the way down to sub-nano electron volts on that end. So there are a number of astrophysical limits on what the axion mass can be, which basically tend to make the axion ruled out if it has a mass that's heavier than a few milli-electron volts. So for axions heavier than here, there's pretty good astrophysical boundaries which prohibit that. So the axion mass can basically be at the milli-electron volts scale down to nano-electron volts and even smaller. Depending on the model of cosmology, if you have high energy scale inflation, there'd be too much cold dark matter in some models where the axion would need to be heavier than about kind of micro EV. So then one has this sort of traditional axion window between kind of micro EV and a few milli EV. And so the ADMX cavity experiment is covering this area here. That's this shaded gray band. The Gen 2 version of that is covering this green area here. But there's really no existing experiments that are kind of looking between where this limit ends and then the astrophysical limits start to pick up. And so the aim of the Ariadne experiment is to fill this gap in between where these second generation cavity experiments start to peter out and then the astrophysical limits start to come in. And then some of these other new experiments that are being developed are looking at even lighter mass axions below micro EV. Okay, so we're looking for axions as they are force mediators. So in particular, if I have nucleons, we can exchange an axion. So generically speaking, the axion should couple to fermions with some scalar coupling that's proportional to theta QCD. And then there's also generically a pseudoscalar coupling, which in the non-relativistic limit looks like the gradient of the axion field dotted into the spin, sigma. And so if I have two nucleons coming together, we can exchange the axion as a force mediator and have different kinds of couplings. So in particular, I could have a monopole coupling with two scalar terms. I could have a monopole dipole coupling with the pseudoscalar and scalar, or I could have a dipole-dipole coupling with two of the pseudoscalar terms. So Ariadne is looking for the middle term here, where we want to look for this so-called monopole-dipole interaction between two nucleons. And the way we're going to do that is to look for a spin-dependent force at short distance. So just like my cartoon earlier with the two masses looking at the Newtonian potential, now we've basically replaced one of the masses with a spin. And so I have some length scale here separating the mass, separating two fermions, where there's a coupling between the mass of one fermion essentially and the spin of another. And this is the potential then that one can write down from this monopole-dipole axion exchange. Here's the product of those two coupling constants that we had in the previous view graph. There's an exponential term here which is causing this potential to die off quickly at short distance, where this length scale here is now the Compton wavelength corresponding to the mass of the axion. And then I have a 1 over r squared kind of dependence here. And then I also have this spin dependence where I have sigma dot r, where r is the vector separating the fermions. Now, because this thing couples to sigma, and sigma for a fermion is proportional to its magnetic moment, one can think about this as an effective or a fictitious type magnetic field where it couples to the magnetic moment of the particle. But I want to emphasize this is not a regular magnetic field. It doesn't obey Maxwell's equations. It doesn't couple to moving charges or angular momentum. And what's most important for our experiment is that it's actually not going to be affected by magnetic shielding, which will allow us to screen out ordinary magnetic fields while at the same time being sensitive to this effective fictitious magnetic field. Okay, so if you want to detect this tiny magnetic interaction, magnetic-like interaction, one way of doing that is using NMR, or nuclear magnetic resonance. And so, for example, if I have a mass that I bring by my spin, so for the spin, let's take as an example a spin 1/2 helium-3 nucleus. And if I put this helium-3 nucleus in a magnetic field that's external, I'll generate some energy splitting between the spin up and spin down state, where this energy difference is basically given by h bar times the nuclear Larmor precession frequency, which is proportional to the applied field. And so if I were then to bring this other fermion nearby with some mass at some close range r, then what I would do is basically modify this effective magnetic field that the particle is sitting in. And the nuclear Larmor precession frequency here would be modified as I bring that nearby mass. And so one can do a precision magnetometry experiment to search for this effect as changes in the nuclear Larmor frequency. And there have been some experiments that have been done of this kind, which have put some constraints on these anomalous spin-dependent forces at short distance. So here now I have on the vertical axis the product of those two coupling constants. And then along the horizontal scale, I have the force range or the Compton wavelength of the axion or axion-like particle. And then corresponding to that, the mass of the axion from milli EV down to micro-EV range. So these magnetometry experiments have been able to rule out this, what's above this shaded blue band here in this upper corner. If one takes into account the best limits from astrophysics as well as experimental constraints, it's possible to make a more aggressive boundary on this plot that's shown here by this tan region. But if you were to ask, well, for the QCD axion, where do you expect the natural place to be for this product of the coupling constants? Then, in fact, what you expect is something in this shaded purple band here, which is now many orders of magnitude below the range of the current bounds. And so this thing is a band where the upper limit of this thing, this again, the product, the scalar and the dipole, so the scalar coupling constant here is proportional to theta QCD. So the upper boundary of this band is constrained by the neutron EDM bound, because we know theta QCD is less than about 10 to the minus 10. But there's also a lower boundary in the band, because there's a certain amount of CP violation that's already present in the standard model. And so we know theta QCD should be bigger than about 10 to the minus 16. So if the axion exists, it should be somewhere in between this shaded area. OK, so how can we do better and get closer to that? And so Ariadne uses a resonant technique, much like the previous experiment I mentioned, where we're going to use that resonant enhancement to get good sensitivity. And so now, again, let's consider that I have a spin 1/2 helium-3 nucleus, and I put it in some external magnetic field. And when I do that, I generate energy splitting between the spin-up and spin-down states. But now, rather than just statically bringing along a mass and leaving it nearby, I'm going to modulate the distance of this mass to the nearby fermion. And so when I do that, I'm now modulating the strength of this effective fictitious magnetic field. And I'm doing that in such a way that the motion of this object coincides with the nuclear Larmor resonance frequency. And so when I do that, I resonantly drive the precession of this spin. And so now this gives me a big enhancement, because I can get an effective quality factor, which is given by the frequency times the T2, or the transverse coherence time in the helium-3, which can be quite large. And then I can, as a signal, just detect this transverse magnetization that's precessing as a result of that interaction. So the actual experiment doesn't look like a couple of balls. It looks something more like this, where we have a mass. Now, the mass here is unpolarized. It's a dense material, so we're using tungsten in our case, where it's machined into the teeth of this kind of gear-like structure. And so this is put near a vessel here, which contains the helium-3, which we're doing the NMR on. And in between the two, we have a layer of superconducting magnetic shielding, which we need to block ordinary magnetic field noise from acting on the helium-3. And then there's a squid that we have to measure the magnetic moment of the helium. And so in the experiment, the idea is that this unpolarized cylinder or sprocket-shaped mass here is rotating. And we arrange it so that the teeth of this gear are now passing by the helium at the nuclear Larmor precession frequency. And so we're, again, driving the transverse polarization, transverse magnetization of the spin, and then picking that up with the squid sensor. Now, the fundamental limit of this technique comes from the quantum projection noise in the sample itself, which goes like 1 over the square root of the volume times the density times this T2 factor, the transverse coherence time factor. OK, so what we want to do for this experiment is have a highly polarized medium. We can't use ordinary magnetic fields to polarize the nuclear spin with near unity polarization, because the ordinary magnetic fields are just not strong enough. So we use techniques from AMO physics, in particular optical pumping, to achieve this. And this is a photo of the apparatus that our collaborators have at Indiana University, where we use something called metastability exchange optical pumping, where basically by exciting the helium atom into a metastable state, you can then optically pump it. And then through collisions, you'll wind up polarizing the ground state with near unity polarization. So the cryostat design for the main part of the experiment looks something like this. We have the source mass here. That's this rotating tungsten disk. This is rotated on a shaft from a rotation stage above it. And then we have the helium contained in three sample chambers. So we're using three different ones so that we can look for correlations between the signals in the three. And so if I were to zoom in and look, kind of look down at this interface where the source mass gets close to the sample chamber, you'd see this. So here's the source mass with one of its teeth here. And then the helium-3 is in this sample chamber, which is embedded in a quartz block. The quartz block is coated with a thin film of niobium superconductor to block magnetic noise from interacting with the helium. And so then this device spins, and we look for the magnetization using a squid pickup. And so this wheel here has 11 segments in it, and we're targeting a nuclear precession frequency of about 100 hertz with a helium density of about 10 to the minus 21 per cubic centimeter for the spin density. The volume of the sample chamber is about 1 centimeter by a couple millimeters by 150 microns, with an average separation distance here of about 200 microns between the sample and the source mass. And we're using tungsten to get a very high density. So for this geometry, we're projecting the following sensitivity, where now, depending on the T2 time, where if we're very pessimistic and the T2 time is only 1 second, or if we think more reasonably optimistic and the T2 time can be up to 1,000 seconds, we can now carve out the space that it would be everything above this red band. And the point is now we can start to probe potentially into the allowed parameter space for the QCD axion at this length, at this kind of milli-EV to 100 micro-unique kind of length scale. If one were to scale up the system, assuming things work well, it's potentially possible to think about getting this projected reach line here where we can now carve out about half of that allowed parameter space. If I look at the fundamental limit from the squid magnetometer, its sensitivity would allow us to carve out nearly the entire region. So we're excited to see how well this actually works in the lab. It's not an easy experiment by any stretch of the imagination. There are a number of systematic effects and noise sources that we're worried about. I'm not going to go through this list and bore you with too many details. I'll just mention that in both simulation and design work and in laboratory tests, we're actively looking at three different possible areas where there could be problems. So in particular, we have a strategy for eliminating magnetic gradients, which are deleterious for our experiment. We're looking into characterizing mechanical vibrations. And then also we're looking at characterizing the shielding factor of our superconducting shielding, which is necessary to mitigate a lot of the magnetic noise kind of backgrounds in the system. Okay, so in the interest of time, I think I'm going to skip over some of the details of this, and I can return if there are questions. And this is just showing some of the work in progress where we're testing the rotation mechanism for the system to make sure that the speed is stable enough to utilize really high T2 times. Here we've demonstrated the one of the candidate rotation stages is typically is operating at around part in 10 of the 4 level, which looks very encouraging. We've done some preliminary testing or fabrication of the detectors for the magnetometers, where sensitivity is looking certainly good enough for our measurement around 100 hertz here, close to 4 femtotesla per root hertz. And we've also done some testing of the superconducting shielding, where we ideally would like a shielding factor of about 10 to the 8 or so. And we're demonstrating so far right in that range with a niobium tube shield. And we're continuing tests now with thin film superconductors that hopefully will see similar performance in the next few months. Okay, so I'm just going to go ahead and summarize at this point. So I talked about two different kinds of resonant experiments, which could potentially look at different kinds of fundamental physics. First, with optically trapped nanospheres, where we're doing precision tests of gravity. One could imagine also Casimir measurements and possibly gravitational wave searches in the future. And then Ariadne is a new NMR method that's intended to fill in this gap in the QCD axion search where there's really no existing experiment in town. And it's very complementary to the other kind of experiments where we don't need to scan over the mass of the axion. We basically searched for all the axion masses at the same time. And because we're sourcing the accent in the lab, and it's independent of any assumptions about the local dark matter density, and us and our collaborators are working hard to do some preliminary tests where we hope to eventually build up this experiment in the next year or so. And with that, I want to just acknowledge our funding agencies and the people actually doing the work, and thank you for your attention.
Thank you. Time for comments or questions.
I have a question about magnetic impurities and the mass. You said, so if there are some, right, they will also use
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah,
so that is the same as your signal, right?
Yeah, that's right. That's buried in this table here, so
right.
I didn't go through one. But so one of the things is magnetic impurities in the test mass, and also the susceptibility of the test mass. If you have some background field that magnetizes it, those would both give you a signal that look kind of like what we want. But
do you have experimental ways of discriminating?
Yeah, so with the impurities, you know, it depends somewhat on the density distribution of the impurities. If it's just sort of one localized impurity, of course, it's going to look like a pretty different signal. If it's uniformly distributed impurities, it could produce a problematic effect. And so that leads to what the requirement is, depending on the level of impurities, gives us a requirement on the shielding that we would need in order to suppress it at a level that we couldn't see. And so for the 10 to the 8 number for the shielding, that would be sufficient to reach the full design sensitivity against all of the systematic. But that is something that, in principle, would look like an effect that would be with the same sort of phase structure and so forth as the signal we're looking for. Another similar effect is actually from this so-called Barnett effect, which is maybe not as well known. So if you take an object that's not magnetic, it's not a ferromagnet, it's just say it's a paramagnet, and you rotate it, you induce a magnetization in it just upon its rotation, from conservation of angular momentum. It's the opposite of the Einstein de Haas effect, where if you have if you change the magnetization, you can cause something to spin if it's suspended from a thin wire, right? And so that magnetization upon rotation also would give you a signal that would vary with the teeth of the cylinder as it passes by. But again, now you're limited by how good your shielding factor is. And actually, we're planning on using that as a tool to check the system, where if we deliberately go above the supergrading transition, we should be able to see that effect. Yeah?
The Barnett effect depends on the magnetic susceptibility?
Yes.
But then you have the magnetic susceptibility
well,
as a separate entry?
Yeah, so even completely statically, if it's not spinning, mm-hmm. if you have a static background field, you're gonna create a magnetic magnetization in the sample.
Oh.
And that will create a local magnetic field variation near the teeth, right? So that thing spinning, even apart from the Barnett effect, gives you an additional problem, right?
I don't know if I'm allowed to ask this question, but can you give more of a timeline when you
timeline? Yeah. So basically, right. So we're currently funded from NSF to do some tests of these things that I've circled here, right? So that's going on for the remainder of this year. We would like to start building the real apparatus next April or May, and then it'll take probably 2 years to get it fully commissioned. So probably taking data 2 years or so after that.
We'll come back in a couple of years.
Yeah.
Okay, so let's hang on to it.